I think everybody here knows John from his widespread presence as a correspondent and reporter in all media, a war correspondent in Somalia and Afghanistan, Gulf War in the Middle East, prominent on television. And my favorite time with John was spent listening to Talk of the Nation. He's won 3 Peabodys, 4 Emmys, has 5 children. I think his wife Allison helped a little bit with that last achievement. But I want to tell you just a little something that's special to me. Just yesterday, the Media Laboratory, where I spent most of my career in technology and teaching, celebrated its 25th anniversary, which makes me seem unbelievably old. They're like dog years, and 25 in dog years is ancient if you're a laboratory. John was kind enough to manage the afternoon as an MC, which he did with great specialness in ways that I think almost no other reporter or journalist could have done. And the reason for that is characteristic of the way John approaches all of the things that he does. He didn't just sort of zip into the lab and do a story and cover the event, so to speak, sort of trot in and trot out as MC. He has been in residence at the laboratory on and off, and I think spent a whole year there as a kind of visiting scholar. He immersed himself in the culture. He wasn't just reporting on the sort of bubbles and fizz of the place and the gizmos and gadgets, sort of neat technologies, but he was really understanding the extraordinary people who have built the place, who make it go, people who range from Nicholas Negroponte, who founded it, to all of the wonderful students who you don't know but who really are the lifeblood of it. And it's only a person like that who really takes the time to immerse themselves and understand the richness of what is a very complex and remarkable situation like that laboratory. Only such a person could really, I think, have shepherded the 25th anniversary celebration yesterday the way John did. And for much the same reason, he's the perfect person to manage the panel you're about to hear. So it's a real treat for me to introduce John Hockenberry. Sorry to take so much of your time, but come on out and let's get started.
I think the title, The Tendencies of Technology, is both mysterious and kind of general, but is really right on, because I think all of the people on this panel, and probably all of you in this community of thinkers and anticipators of trends, particularly in the technological and scientific realm, understand that sometimes it is humanity that drives technology, and sometimes it's technology that drives humanity, and the precise sort of interlink between the human scale of ideas, the almost individual scale of ideas that become technology and devices and then movements and then manifestos and then perhaps self-critical exercises and, oh my God, what have we done? In the case of television, you'll hear a lot of criticism of television this morning. I'm sure that won't bother you at all here in Boston. But as someone who's actually been on both sides of that, worked in television, grew up, you know, looking at the box, and then really seeing the world of proliferating screens in the digital revolution, and then as a foreign correspondent, seeing the manifestations of technology, both in terms of its imposition on civilizations around the world, in the developing world, in the undeveloped world, technology has tendencies, and perhaps that's too soft a word. And so the people that we're going to speak with and listen to this morning have written manifestos, have described movements, have anticipated the future, have talked about technology both in terms of pushing back on it and in embracing and accepting it. And I hope that you'll find that this morning and that this session, which is deliberately longer to allow for your questions, will be as exciting as it certainly is going to be for me. So let's first of all welcome and give a warm round of applause to the panelists, Nick Bilton, Kevin Kelly, David Kirkpatrick, and Nicholas Negroponte. Come on out, guys. Nick Bilton is the lead technology writer for the New York Times Bits blog, a reporter for the New York Times, and his new book is I Live in the Future, and Here's How It Works. Nick.
Thank you very much. So, can you hear me? Yes. So I'm going to give a 10-minute talk. I'd urge you to look at the slides because they're better looking than I am. Like John just said, I'm the lead technology writer at the New York Times. I also teach at NYU, and I'm just going to tell you for 1 minute a few things that I've done recently in the past few years that are relevant to what we're all doing here today. One of the classes I teach at NYU is called 1-2-10, and it's about designing interaction for what I call the 1-foot, 2-foot, 10-foot experience, and it's the distance that screens are from your face. So your mobile phone is 1 foot, your computer 2 feet, and television, of course, 10 feet. And what we really look at in this course is how all these devices are converging together and how stories and books and movies and things will all follow you between all these different devices. I also teach a course called Telling Stories with Sensors, Data, and Humans. And what we did was we asked if a sensor can become a journalist or can a sensor become a reporter? Can a sensor write actually narratives? And we took these open source little hardware devices called Arduinos and put sensors all over them in the class, and we placed them all over NYU, and we actually found out that we could tell stories with them. And they were sensing distance and sound and light and all these different things. And this is actually the floor at NYU where I teach. And we monitored students coming and going and how they and what they did when they were there, and then had these graphs made in real time using these things. And it turns out that we were able to tell really interesting stories. Over here, you can see the left and right elevator. It turns out that kids take the left elevator more than the right elevator. They don't actually use the stairs. We didn't need sensors to tell ourselves that, but still, it was interesting. They they congregate in certain areas based on light patterns and things like that. So it was a really fascinating research project. Before I was a reporter at the Times, I was in the research and development labs, and we did a lot of different projects. One was called Newspaper 2.0, and it was looking at what replaces paper, which I think is extremely relevant to the book industry too. A lot of research around flexible devices. And what we can actually see happening as far as the price of these devices and when they'll be at the inflection point in the market that they kind of change the way consumers read and interact with information. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the research in my book, I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works. And so I figured I'd start off with the first chapter, which is about the porn industry. It's called Bunny's Markets in the Bottom Line. And the reason that I actually started to research the porn industry for the book was because it turns out a lot of people consume this kind of content on the internet. Actually, 30,000 times a second, somebody types in this word into a search engine. So that's a lot. It's actually 50 million of your fellow Americans have done the same thing. And with that in mind, I went out and I started looking at the kind of money that the porn industry is making. It turns out in 2006, they made close to $3 billion online just from online revenue alone, not including other sales. So I thought about this and I said, well, maybe they can actually show us what the future of books and newspapers and things will look like. And with that, also, the adult industry has always been at the forefront of a lot of technologies. There was a really interesting paper that was written in the early 90s by Peter Johnson, a very famous lawyer, who looked at the implications that adult content had on other industries. It turns out that when the printing press came along in the 1500s, there were two types of books that did really well. There was the Bible, of course, and then adult books that were these stories about things that people were not supposed to be doing. The porn industry figured out how to make money from the 900 numbers on the telephone. They innovated with CD-ROMs. And you can follow this through all the way through to today. So I took this trip out to California, and I said to myself, maybe I can find out all of these answers and come back, and the publishing industry will embrace me with open arms, and I'll tell them how this is all going to work in the future. And it turns out I was wrong. Playboy, for example, their stock has fallen from $25 in the beginning of the decade to $5 now. The company has lost $100 million every year for the last 5 years. Penthouse, another publication, they went bankrupt, and they were sold to a startup, friendfinder.com, because they couldn't figure out how to innovate. Hustler, the only reason they're actually still in business is because they diversified and invested in things that weren't adult content. So I couldn't figure out what was happening. And what happened, it turns out, is the reason these companies went out of business is because they kept trying to push their print business models and their DVDs and things like that. So Playboy didn't innovate online. It kept saying, here, customer, buy this print thing, buy this $50 DVD. And the customer was like, no, I don't want to buy that. So I asked, where was this $3 billion coming from? Where was it being created and who was making money? And it turns out that in the place of these huge giants, these huge mainstream publications, were these niche products that started to appear all over the web where they could charge a minimal amount of money and they didn't have to worry about infrastructures of print costs and printing presses and so on. and they started to make a lot of money online. And what they told me was that what they were doing that was different is they were giving the customer whatever they wanted. So if somebody wanted to buy a piece of content that was on their mobile phone at 4 o'clock in the morning in Brooklyn, they'll sell it to you. If you want a high definition 3D experience on your television, they'll sell you that too. And what they realized is that they're not just selling content. They're not just selling the videos and words and things like that. They're selling an entire experience. And this was an interesting graph that was done from the Journal of Economic Perspectives that looks at how much people are willing to pay for this kind of content. And you can see this price point where it drops off. And this is really relevant to what's happening today. We can see that these changes are happening where the mainstream media is still trying to push their print products, right? The publishers are still trying to push their books. The music industry is still trying to push its CDs. And in their place, there's these small little blogs and music startups and people that go direct to e-readers and things like that that are taking the place of those publications. So there is more to life than porn, it turns out, and that's only one chapter in the book. So I wanted to talk about something else that I think is really relevant to what we're going through today. We hear a lot of fears around ebooks and e-readers and screens and things like that, and that multitasking is really bad for us. I've always been this way where I can't concentrate. And it turns out when I was actually doing research for my book, I came across my old report cards from when I was a kid in school. And there's this really funny thing that followed me through my life. And it was literally from the 3 years old to 18, Nicholas can't concentrate, right? And it was just every single class, right? And I said to myself, well, wait a second. Isn't society becoming a society that can't concentrate? So I kept saying to myself, well, I've been this way my entire life. I can't concentrate unless I'm multitasking and doing several different things at once, right? If I'm engaging with all of these different things, I'm at peace with the world. But we've all been told that multitasking is really bad for us, right? That it's a really bad experience and that we shouldn't be using multiple screens at the same time. But it turns out that's not exactly true. It's actually, it's completely inaccurate. And if you look, we can do different tasks at the same time if we jump between these tasks simultaneously. So if I'm watching a football game and tweeting about that game, it's okay for my brain to do that. If I'm text messaging and tweeting at the same time while driving, that's not a good idea. And I just want to, we've been through this before, right? We've been through these fears of e-readers and things like that before. I actually call it technochondria. It's a fear of new technologies. Turns out when the train came out, there was this fear in society that traveling on a train over 20 miles an hour, we could asphyxiate and die. There was all of these things happen with the telephone, with other devices like that. We're going through this with video games right now, where we're afraid of video games and we're afraid of what they're going to do to society. It turns out that all the neuroscience shows that video games are really good for us. There's research around Tetris that shows that kids that play Tetris have better hand-eye coordination, increased working memory. They're better at taking tests. The same thing with first-person shooter video games. We think that they're bad for us because of what they are. But kids that play first-person shooter video games actually have the visual acuity of someone who's deaf, and they have a faster working memory than those that don't. And people that play video games are actually better surgeons. There was a research study done that found that laparoscopic surgeons are 60% faster and 40% more accurate than those that haven't played video games. And what's happening with all of this is our brains are adapting, and they're adapting to these e-readers and these devices. And it's really important to note that it's not evolution, right? What's actually happening is that our brains are built to adapt to these devices, right? Our brains are built to adapt to e-readers and other technologies. The fascinating piece of research that I found when I was looking at the book is everyone says don't play video games and don't use e-readers. You've got to read books. It's a part of humanity. But it turns out we were never even designed to read. Right? It's something that we've hijacked our brain to do. We use the part of our brain that we used to use to discover symbols and objects, and we actually recorrelate that for reading. And there's been research studies, this was one that was done, that scanned people's brains before and after they learned how to read, and we actually rewire our brains to learn how to read. And we're doing the same thing with digital content and digital experiences, and we're creating this new kind of narrative. And so when we look at this next generation of kids that are growing up with these devices, there's nothing wrong with them experiencing content in this way. It's just the way that they consume information. And I just wanted to take 1 second and just walk through some of the arguments that we hear about this. We keep talking about how we're going to sell content to these kids, right? But and how we're going to sell business models. And I don't think people pay for content. I think people pay for experiences, and it goes back to the porn industry, right? You can see this with how we buy content, right? So if I buy the New York Times, I'm buying an entire experience, right? If I said I was going to sell you the New York Times on Post-it notes, would you still want to pay for it? No. Right, because it wouldn't be a great experience. So what we're paying for now, and what we have to sell to consumers, and what consumers want is they want a conversation, they want community, and they want the ability to create. I'm just going to wrap up with this last slide. This was Barack Obama's daughter during the inauguration, right? And there's a million people here, right? There's a million cameras. There's the best photojournalists in the world, but this little girl wanted to take photos with her Kodak camera, put them online, and have a conversation with their friends about them. And so when we look at how the narrative is changing, it's not necessarily a one-way experience anymore that came with print. It's a two-way conversation that we now have. So thank you.
So our next guest and presenter, Kevin Kelly, is certainly a legend in the telling of the narrative of technology. He helped launch Wired magazine in 1993, served as its executive editor for nearly 7 years. He's the best-selling author of New Rules for the New Economy and Out of Control. He loves to probe the disruptive qualities of technology and actually create a lot of the disruptions himself. His provocative and controversial new book is What Technology Wants. And I've known Kevin for a long time, and he's also someone who I like to think of as the person most likely to have pictures of what you did at Burning Man. please welcome Kevin Kelly.
So I'd be very, very happy to kind of talk about what technology wants, because I'm interested in what actually technology is. And that definition up there is sort of what we normally associate with technology. We can talk about the next 5 minutes, what's going to happen tomorrow, today, next year. But I like to think that we're surrounding ourselves with this stuff, and we should ask ourselves, what is it really in the long term? What is it that we're surrounding ourselves with? And I want to kind of step back and take a longer view and say, where does technology fit into the cosmos? And so it has to be more than just, you know, things that were invented in the last 5 minutes. It might just be things that don't work yet. That's another way we think of it. But it's actually a relatively new idea. I did a search of the State of the Union talks from the birth of this country for over 200 years, and the word technology didn't really appear until around 1952. So the idea, the very concept in our mind that we have a name for all this stuff around us is actually really very relative. The word itself was actually coined in 1829, the first time in English, and it was someone who gathered a bunch of topics and made a course out of it, and he called it technology. It was previously called the applied arts. And so until very recently, we didn't even have a name for all this stuff that was surrounding us. And I still think that we don't really have a good grasp of what it is, because I'm not interested in just the little gadgets, the things that are in your pockets, or the railroads and the internet and the things that we associate with steam shovels or chemicals. I think that what's happening is that we're creating a ecosystem of things and that these things are codependent upon each other. So the little device that you have in your pocket probably requires about 1,000 other technologies to create. There's no human alive that could just create it by themselves. There's a whole infrastructure. And that infrastructure itself, like many, many other large systems, begins to accumulate its own internal biases and tendencies. And I call this whole thing as a whole, I call it the technium, just to give it a name. It's bigger than culture because it's interdependent. It has a complex, adaptive nature which exhibits its own agenda. So I like to think of technology as anything that was invented by a mind. That's my definition of it. And when we begin to look at it as a large system, we begin to see that it exhibits many of the same kinds of behaviors that life does. For instance, there is an increasing diversity in life. Life starts off very simple, and over time and evolution, it becomes more and more diverse. It accumulates species, and here's existing a kind of a taxonomic array of different spark catchers from the 1800s. We can get the sense that a camera is initially very general, and then we have more and more specialized versions of it. So the same thing happens with life. And this is an extension of a kind of a force in evolution that wants to move towards increasing specialization, increasing diversity. So we start with a hammer, kind of a general hammer, the initial caveman hammer, and then over time we get more specialized hammers. We start with a kind of a general computer, and actually over time we're going to become more and more specialized, despite the fact that there seems to be a temporary convergence into your pocket. Over time, things become more specialized. I like to think of this then, in some ways, that the dynamics of the technium are, in some ways, an outgrowth of life itself. And so those are the six kingdoms of life, and out of the animal kingdom, we have the seventh kingdom of life. So if we abstract it far enough away, we can actually see that technology is and behaves in the same way over the long term in its evolutionary pathway, the same way as life does. So this seventh kingdom of life, again, we can exhibit and map it out. It looks, sometimes this is sort of the genealogy, the life tree of medieval helmets, and the way in which they kind of, their forms trace the same kind of path. And this is a guy, Niles Eldridge, who, with Stephen Jay Gould, co-founded the theory of punctuated equilibrium. His specialty in biology is tribolites, which he maps and does kind of measures the different forms and shows how they're kind of related. And his hobby is collecting cornets, which he actually has mapped in the same way he might have mapped his tribolites to find out that, in fact, they do follow a very similar pathway in their evolution as biological organisms of his tribolites. What's interesting about this, though, the difference between biological evolution and technological evolution is that while species go extinct in biology, they don't go extinct in technology. So you can buy today for $50 or so a brand new shirt knife that is made exactly the same way as it was 50,000 years ago. Exactly the same process, exactly the same tool. And the idea that technology does not go extinct was sort of strange to me, and I suggested it to a historian of science asking whether this seemed to be true to him, and he said, well, you know, that's crazy. Take the steam-powered cars. They don't make those anymore. So I looked on the internet, and within 5 minutes I found a place you could buy a brand new valve for a Stanley steam-powered automobile. And so I then kind of set a challenge. I said, here's the website for it, by the way. You can buy new parts for your steam-powered automobile. They're still making them in new parts. I decided to take a catalog page from the 1898 edition of the Montgomery Ward's catalog of old farm implements. And I said, surely they can't be making these anymore. And I found out you could buy brand new every single one of them. Somewhere in the world, either the Amish or somebody in India or somewhere, they're making these new. They're still new. So technologies don't go extinct. That's the difference. Is they're idea-based, they're resurrected. And that's one of the values, I think, about what technology wants, is it wants to increase the options. And so we normally usually have the options of still using, buying, purchasing, having access to old technology when the new comes along. So we're often obsessed with the new, but most of our lives are surrounded by things that are old. So this again goes to the idea that we think of technology as only things that were invented after we were born, but most of the technology in our lives was invented long before we were born and still around with us. But the important thing is that technology has its own agenda. I'm not saying that technology is conscious or that it has intelligence. I'm just saying that it has a drift towards things in the same way that a plant might want to aim towards light. It's not thinking about it. It just has a tendency, an urgency to go towards the light. Technology has its own agenda. For instance, I did a calculation to figure out that 3/4 of the energy used on this planet is used for the benefit of technology and not for us. For instance, the energy used in your automobile, 3/4 of it is used to move the automobile and not you. So in a certain sense, technology is now serving mostly itself by using energy and the transportation of stuff. It's a system that is feeding itself in a large sense. So we have this idea of selfish technology that's slightly selfish. At the same time, obviously, it's bringing us benefits. And I think this duality, this tension between the selfish aspects of technology and this generous thing will never leave us. And that's in part because we are both the creators of technology and the created. We ourselves have been domesticated. We're the first domesticated animals. We changed ourselves by inventing cooking. Cooking allowed us to digest things that we could not digest normally. That cooking changed our teeth, changed our jaws. We have changed ourselves biologically through this invention of our mind. We continue to do that. We're just beginning to change ourselves. So we are both the created and the creators. We are both the masters of technology. We are both the slaves of it. And that will forever be true as long as technology reigns. And technology will reign because if it was to be eliminated, we would die within 6 weeks. We're incapable now as a species to live without at least some technology. The other thing I discovered in my investigation of what technology wants is that all inventions are simultaneous. It doesn't matter what it is. You can find multiple priorities of invention simultaneously, independently, for everything. The light bulb was invented about 23 different times independently. Thomas Edison was the last first inventor of the light bulb. The patents for the telephone were applied within 3 hours. Besides Alexander Graham Bell, there was Gray who applied for patents within 3 hours. It doesn't matter which one invention you look at. That's why we have a patent system, because everybody knows if they don't apply now, someone else will. This suggests, in the history of other evidence, that there is an inevitability to technological change. If when the time is right, it will come. And there is a sense, looking at evidence in other continents when there was no history, again, that the sequence of technological change is pretty much inevitable. So that suggests something very powerful. And that suggests that we can actually prepare for the things that are coming. So because we know that they're going to be inevitable, we can actually educate ourselves and our children, and we can actually prepare to reap the benefits and minimize the downsides. The web was inevitable. Now, what kind of web we have, that was not determined. We can decide what it wants. We can decide whether it wants to be open or transparent or flexible, or whether it's owned, centralized, or owned by the government, whether it's decentralized. Those are the kinds of things we have to decide about technology, what expression that it has. But that it wants something is inevitable. I was stood before this robot, which plugs itself in. It kind of roams around the Willow Garage campus and looking for power. And when it finds power, it plugs itself in. And I stood in front of it while it was trying to find power. And it was very, very clear that it wanted something. So I think what technology gives us is really basically progress, and it's not just more. We have more of things. Of course, we have more of things. I counted the number of objects in our household. There was around 10,000 objects. I looked at the inventory of King Henry VIII. He had 18,000 objects in his household, but his household doubled as the wealth of England. However, in his household and in all his wealth, he could not buy a tube of antibiotics or safe, comfortable ride 500 miles, or refrigeration. So the rickshaw wala in India actually is wealthier than King Henry in many, many ways. So, I mean, technology wants the same things that we want. High technology needs clean water. It's not adverse to biology. It's sympathetic because it is the seventh kingdom of life. It's selfish and generous at the same time. I'm going to go through this. But what we're trying to find out is where new technologies come from. If you have a bad idea, what's the response to a bad idea? It's not to stop thinking. The response to a bad idea is to have a better idea. The response to a bad technology is really to have a better idea. Okay, so So that's the response. It's not to have less idea, less technology, is to have better technologies. And I think our jobs as humans is to cultivate these technologies. Every technology is a creative force looking for the right job, the right place. There are no bad technologies, just as there's no bad children. We're just trying to find the right things for them to do. I want to close with one idea, which is that what technology gives us, in the end, what it wants is to increase our possibilities, options, and choices. That's what it's about. That's what the long-term trend is. Imagine everybody in the world has, just said they have different faces. You have a different mix of abilities and talents. And what we all want is for you to find the final expression of those abilities and talents. And sometimes that requires technology to unleash it. So imagine the world, the loss to the world, if Mozart had been born before the invention of the technologies of the piano or the symphony, and what a tremendous loss to civilization that would have been. Or imagine Van Gogh being born before the technologies of oil paint, or Hitchcock before the technologies of the cinema. What a loss that would have been. So I think today there are children being born whose technology has not yet been invented for their genius. There's some Shakespeare somewhere, and we are born for the new media, and we have not yet invented that media for him or her. So we have, in some senses, a moral obligation to increase the amount of technology in the world, because what it brings us is increasing diversity, complexity, evolvability, and more choices. We are technological. We have a moral obligation to increase that, and that is the long arc of technology through the cosmos, which is increasing choices, opportunities, and possibilities. So I want to thank you for your attention.
David, we should note that you're the author of the Facebook Effect, former senior editor for Internet and Technology at Fortune, organized the Techonomy Conference, which addressed technological innovation and economy. Thank you for being here. Can I ask Kevin just one little quick question yes. before we go? You said in your slide that technology is anything created by a mind.
Right.
Your slide said anything useful created by a mind.
Right.
Are you a little ambivalent about the useful?
Well, I think it's utilitarian in the sense that I think the difference is an idea just in your head is not technology unless it comes out and is expressed in some kind of useful way.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I love useful, but I just noticed that ambivalence sure. there. But I'll talk sure. more about that in a moment. David Kirkpatrick, thanks.
Thank you. I generally prefer not to use PowerPoints, and I'm not using them today. If I could make PowerPoints slides as good as those guys, I would use them more often. I really am struck at the degree to which this really is the panel of techno-optimists. I think we all agree with incredible conviction that technology is our only option and our only hope. And in my opinion, you know, we need to find causes for hope. The world is in a really screwed up place. We have enormous challenges that we face. And in fact, my motivation for writing a book about Facebook was really twofold. And the first one was a response to that sense that we need technology as a source of hope, because as I became more and more familiar with Facebook over recent years, I really did become convinced that not only is it perhaps the most widely adopted new technology of our era, but that in many ways it is one of the greatest causes for hope that we have found, and because of its extraordinary power as a communications tool. And I'll get a little bit more into that. But the other reason why I wanted to write a book about Facebook was because in September of 2006, I met Mark Zuckerberg. And at the time, I was like most business journalists. And I do look at the world through the lens of a business journalist, by the way. So my book is very much a business book. It's a history of Facebook and an explanation of what it means as a business, which are quite surprising things. But, you know, so I'm a business journalist in summer of 06, and some PR person calls me and says, you want to meet Mark Zuckerberg? And Facebook was kind of happening at colleges, and I thought it was interesting, and Zuckerberg was beginning to be a little well-known. So I said, sure, yeah, I'll meet him. It wasn't, like, instant, but I was interested, and I met him, and I thought it was a novelty kind of. like everyone at the time. And then, you know, I met him at a restaurant. I tell the story in the book, in Manhattan, a fancy Italian restaurant. I'm sitting there. He shows up in his T-shirt and sandals. And he was so young-looking. He and Chris Hughes were there. They were both so young-looking, I was almost embarrassed. I mean, I literally could be their grandfather. And I thought, sort of, what am I doing here? And then he started talking. And honestly, Mark Zuckerberg, from the first time I spoke with him, impressed me with extraordinary force at the scope of his thinking. And I think the scope of his thinking is one of the key reasons why Facebook is what it is today. And so, you know, I came back from that meeting and I wrote a piece called Why Facebook Matters. And in September of 06, it was quite unusual for a business journalist to say that Facebook mattered. It was still a student thing. But, you know, there are all kinds of other things about that time period. The newsfeed controversy, which was the biggest protest of its members, the biggest privacy problem Facebook has ever faced, was raging at the moment I met him. And he wasn't even interested in talking about it because he was more interested in talking about his long-term plans. And he was so absolutely certain that it would wane and disappear as an issue, as of course it did. And now the newsfeed is the central feature of Facebook. So then Facebook just started growing. You know, it was 9 million when I met him, 9 million active users. By the end of 06, I think it was around 15 million. When they launched the platform, which I wrote a big piece about in May of 07, it was 24 million. By the end, there's active users. And by then, it had expanded to adults. It happened right after I met him, actually. And then by the end of 07, it was around 50, 55 million active users. And as a business journalist covering technology, which was what I did, I had never seen anything like that because nothing like that had ever existed. Facebook was and is almost certainly the fastest growing company of any type in human history. And so, you know, at 55 million, I thought, you know, this thing is really unusual. This kid is incredible. I should write a book about it. So I saw Zuckerberg at Davos in early 2008, and I said to him, you know, I think I want to write a book about your company. And it was just, you know, in the course of a conversation, we were talking about other things, and he immediately said, go for it, which was great for me. And I had his endorsement, and, you know, he knew that I kind of grokked what he was doing, and that was kind of key to my project. And it's certainly true that I am a believer in Facebook's importance and a believer in Mark Zuckerberg's importance. And so today now it's 550 million active users. And it is clearly going to a billion. And its growth is not even primarily in places like the one where we live. It is primarily in Indonesia, in Egypt, in Chile, in Nicaragua, in Azerbaijan, in Kazakhstan. These countries are huge sources of growth for Facebook. It's in the languages spoken by 96% of the population of the planet. And its impacts are very many, which is why I call my book The Facebook Effect, because it's a history of Facebook as a way to explain all the various things that Facebook has come to mean. And I am very struck in particular by its significance in the political realm, and I begin my book with a political anecdote. Now, many people don't really give Facebook that much thought as a political and social force. They just think of it as something that my kid joined to meet their friends at the mall, which is why they join. But the thing that I find fascinating is that once you join Facebook in order to agree to meet your friends at the mall, if and when, as inevitably happens, you acquire something else that you want to convey to a large group of people, what are you going to use to do that other than the most efficient communication system that you have ever used? And that is happening all over the world, definitively. So whether you are concerned about a pothole in your street or, like in Iran, a stolen government in your country, a stolen election, or like in Egypt, the corruption of Mubarak, or in, you know, Indonesia, the, you know, entrenched selfishness of the elite, Facebook is the tool that people in those countries are using to combat and undercut those phenomena. And you know, one of the things I say is this, you know, the era we're living in is an era of empowerment. And Facebook is the ultimate and by far most dramatic example of technological empowerment in the era in which we live, and combined with mobile devices, which are probably the other one of similar scale and scope, it is an extraordinarily powerful combination. So in Indonesia, where 30 million people use Facebook, they're almost all using it on their mobile phones. And, you know, really, we are seeing a fundamental transformation of power relationships in the world today from a top-down world to a empowered bottom. And we don't know where it will lead us. Believe me, it's not a clear path or necessarily an easy path. But Facebook is doing that. And there are other forces doing it, too. Twitter helps doing it. But Twitter doesn't do it the same way, because the quick thing about Twitter is that people don't join Twitter to meet their friends at the mall, because Twitter's a broadcast platform. The people who join Twitter to tweet are generally people with something to sell, like me or these guys, or a company. So, you know, most people aren't on Twitter tweeting with their friends about going, you know, brushing their teeth, even though we hear a lot about that. That's generally a very small percentage of the use of Twitter. So if you're a 22-year-old in Egypt who's mad at Mubarak, Twitter is not going to be your primary tool, because you're not already going to have hundreds of people listening to you on Twitter. It will on Facebook. That's a simple way of explaining it. We could go into that more later if we want. So, you know, just a few things about Facebook that people don't quite get is that, you know, why do the users of Facebook get pissed off so often? Why are there all these series of privacy protests and changes in the interface that get people all confused and angry? The reason for that is that Zuckerberg really runs paranoid. You know, he saw what happened to Friendster, he saw what happened to MySpace, and the reason what happened to Friendster and MySpace is not happening to Facebook and probably won't is because he is unafraid to keep changing his service at every time he gets a good new idea. And he will pull us along with him whether we like it or not, and he's well, you know, we're welcome to leave if we don't like it, but he is not going to allow his service to get irrelevant technologically, and he's very much a believer in all the same things we're talking about. The pace of change is undeniable, and he doesn't think it is. He doesn't try to deny it. I mean, just look, in the last 3 weeks, Facebook did a deal with Skype this week, and I think they did something else big this week, I forget what. They did a, you know, so now you're going to be able to use Skype and Facebook together, enormously powerful. You won't have to remember anybody's number ever again. And when they really complete that integration, you'll probably just be able to click on somebody's name in your friend list and have a video call with them wherever you are, and probably for free. Week before that, they launched the Groups feature, which was the biggest thing they've done to address the problem of privacy, where now you can really create a truly private interaction which doesn't bleed out to people you don't want to have see it, which is one of their biggest challenges, because they've done a very bad job of allowing people to really socialize with their real friends. And then a week before that, they took the photos thing, which is the most popular feature in Facebook, and multiplied the size of the photos you can put up there by 8. So now you can put really, really big photos on Facebook, and they look great, and it's a huge change. The last thing I just want to touch briefly on is the movie. Obviously, a lot of you have seen it. I don't really need PowerPoints for my talk, because everybody knows what Facebook looks like, and most of you have probably seen the movie. The basic point I make about the movie, while it's a great movie, is that a guy like the one depicted in that movie could never have made Facebook. Because someone who was so consumed with insecurity and desire to please others and get girls and be liked and, you know, be angry, all the things that that character is consumed with, would never have had the mind space to be as passionately committed to taking this service and growing it. And the focus and conviction that he's brought to this service and this whole process is beyond belief, and that's one of the reasons it has done so well, because Zuckerberg has absolute unilateral total control of Facebook, which is another odd thing about the story, but you have to read my book to find out about that. But thank you.
Please welcome Nicholas Negroponte. I've known Nicholas for a long time. We've talked a lot here about the fusion of object and technology with a sense of experience. Really, the chief contribution of the brilliant book Being Digital was even in the title, the idea of technology and experience being fused together and being the essential narrative was what that book was all about. Nicholas, yeah. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Um, Well, contrary to the slide that just appeared, I'm not going to talk about one laptop per child, except to use it as an illustration for a tendency that is so unequivocal, it may almost not be worth talking about anymore, but it's particularly appropriate at a book festival to talk about books. And I'm going to do it in the context of one laptop per child, because one of the things that I remind people when we ship that little laptop, of which there are now over 2 million in the world, is that there are 100 books on the laptop. And it could be much more, but the 100 just doesn't take very much space, and it's a nice round number, and we called it the $100 laptop. Never was, it was 160-something, but it's still 100's a nice number, so there are 100 books. And when you ship 100 of these, note 100 again, into an African village, they can each have 100 separate books. Now that's the key, because then you've got 10,000 books in the village. You've got, in rough numbers, 500,000 villages in Africa and 500,000 villages in India, just to take two examples. Now, compute in your head what it would take to ship 10,000 physical books to those 1 million villages. And you would basically have to take out of commission all the 747s on the planet for a day or two to actually move them. So it's unequivocal that as the developing world moves forward, it's going to drive what we call electronic books more than anything else. And that, to me, was actually a bit of a revelation this year. And I started to realize, wait, we just saw that happen with cell phones. We just saw the developing world adopt cell phones a lot faster than the United States did. In fact, still today, because AT&T is so terrible, we get better service in Afghanistan because they have never had landlines. They have never had telephone booths. So that they moved very quickly into wireless handheld cell phones. And they grow very, very quickly. And now, depending who you want to believe, there are 4 billion or 4.5 billion cell phones out there, or cell phone accounts. And so that was driven by the developing world, not the developed world. And the same thing's going to happen, I believe, with electronic books. And the reason I find that so important is that these kids are going to take this for granted. I think it was whose slide showed the little girl. I think it was yours. Was it your slide showed the little girl looking at a piece of an iPad? I heard a story of a 3-year-old girl who had just, and this was just last week, I heard the story, had been shown a Kodakolor print. And when she saw the Kodakolor print on the kitchen table, she put her fingers on it and expanded her fingers.
That's a great story.
Isn't that extraordinary? That it's just, so you say to yourself, tendencies in technology, that's pretty, that really, so these kids, they take this stuff for granted. And it's this, I like this picture because this teacher had never used computers, had never taught in any way except very sort of kids lined up, sitting there perfectly still, frightened to ask a question, corporal punishment as part of the curriculum. And this is the way he teaches now. And those kids run to school with their laptops, and this is what the class looks like every single day. So weave that all into the books, into the tablets, and I'll go sort of fast because it's there's latency in this. Okay. The other thing is that Kindle owners buy twice as many books. And it's you're going to start finding that the number 2 is also probably low. It's going to be much higher. The consumption of books will be enormous. The consumption of paper will drop to 0. Paper's the enemy, not books. And so when people talk, like me, about the death of books, one should really talk about paper. Because the music industry didn't go away when records and CDs went away, and a lot of just examples. In fact, you could argue, and I know Kevin does, and I certainly do, that the real beneficiary in this is the consumer, is the reader. I mean, you've got more choice, more opportunity, and these kids have opportunities, of course, that they've never had before. And we sort of go out of our ways, as it happens to be Nepal, to do it in places that are so remote that it's really, to me, more about the end of isolation. I thought that I was involved 5-6 years ago with the end of poverty, which I'd like to think I am involved with it, but the end of isolation is even more interesting. And when you think of isolation and poverty together, it's a rather deadly cocktail. Probably not necessary to say that, but I'll just click through it anyway. Here's what I said before, but the piece that I didn't mention is that those same kids have 1.7 million free books on the net. And the free, it comes from partly because the copyrights expired or because some people are just cheating, to be honest with you. It doesn't matter. They're still free to those kids, and that's absolutely critical. When we did the laptop, most people didn't notice that there was this mode to use it as a games machine or an electronic book, and that was very important. And one of the things that this laptop does that nobody's copied yet is it works in both the sunlight and at night. So it's both a Kindle and an iPad at the throw of a switch. And that's really important, and that's one of the things that I think in the next 12 months people will see it. You'll see it happening, because I often get asked, you know, should I buy a Kindle or should I buy an iPad? Well, the truth is you want one that does both. You want one that's as light and uses as little power as a Kindle, and you want one that has the luminescence and saturated colors and so on of an iPad. And so both will be in the same place. Probably within the next year. I'll just end with one more slide, is that the people keep talking to me about the physical part of books, and they're going to miss that physical part. And yes, there is a physicality in two senses. One is, when you finished a book, you put it on a shelf, and the shelves in your home and so on, there's a little bit of memory lane there. You walk into the room and you remember those books. You remember which ones. You actually probably remember where they are because you got up on your tiptoes with your right hand and put one in sort of that location. But the other part, the part of turning pages and knowing where you are vis-a-vis the end and the beginning and how much to go, I don't want to dismiss that, but you'll get over it. You'll get over it. And I'll give you an example. Anybody in this room who's over 40 will remember that the use of technology in music was hi-fi. What we wanted to do was recreate in living rooms and other places the quality of sound that was as good as and sometimes better than a live performance. And the better part came because you could put yourself on stage, which you couldn't do as the audience, but that the verisimilitude, the quality of the bass and the tweeters and all of that, and we had things called woofers and these amplifiers and people worried about the need, all of that has gone. None of the kids today care about the quality of the sound. They listen to absolute junk in terms of the quality, but they have this infinite selection and choice and sharing and playlists and so on. It wasn't hi-fi, it's really Wi-Fi. It sort of really changed, and I think we'll see that happening. So I'll end with this last slide, is that so many people say, well, what's the economic model? Stop looking. It's not there. Many of them. One of the things about the internet, and we heard it with the first speaker, there's just going to be many, not just niches in terms of industries, but niche players in sort of publishing in general. And the written word is really our primary form of communication. I'm willing to guess that most people talk a lot less on the telephone than they did 5 years ago. Now, I happen to talk not at all on the telephone, but some people talk a lot, but a lot less probably now than you did 5 years ago. There's a lot more messaging, or even if the messaging is, I'll call you in 5 minutes, versus calling and leaving voicemail, calling and which is really stupid. So at least I can now text you and say, I'll call you in 5 minutes. Do you realize what that does in terms of stopping sort of a gratuitous audio signal? So reading and writing, it's absolutely amazing. The amount of words consumed by kids today is just a lot more than we did as kids, and I think it's going to continue up. Thank you very much.
I mean, you know, I'm having kind of a Gladwellian, you know, obviousology moment here. Why would we expect that technology would not be about experience and life when technology is, in fact, a mapping of objects onto human experience? And the explosion of connected internet technology really sort of makes the picture clear. But books, you know, distributed Christianity because the codex was the first sort of portable use of text. You couldn't carry scrolls around. You couldn't teach. The King James Version of the Bible was the first sort of Facebook page of Christianity, which distributed that across the world. Stalin created the Kalashnikov to confront the Warsaw Pact, and in fact, it became the sort of Walkman of guerrilla insurgency around the world. The idea that users are going to figure this out and make it about life itself. I mean, even hi-fi, the porn of music, right? It's an experience that you want to have at home because it's harder to have the concert experience. Music has become about experience in its proliferation. Pornography, the industry is dying because ultimately hookup is the highest res experience of porn, much better than Playboy and Hustler. Why should we be surprised by any of this, Nick?
Yeah, well, so, but if you think about music, for example, right? Why was iTunes successful? It wasn't that they started selling digital music. It existed way before they came along. They created an experience that people would pay for, right? Which was instantaneous. It was on my iPod in 11 seconds, one click, done. Before that, I mean, I had a Rio MP3 player when I went to buy it. It was the first MP3 player. The guy at Best Buy called me an idiot. He was like, why are you wasting $200 on that thing? It's stupid. And he was right. And it wasn't that, you know,
no longer works at Best Buy. Yeah.
I hope not. I think that that's a really important, when we talk about books and business models and music and all these different things, like, you know, we go to concerts today and we pay $100 to see a live concert when you could download that album for 10 bucks or whatever it is. And it's because I think that we've created these experiences around these products. And I think that is going to happen with books.
Although the
too.
Concert field is growing in many ways because it's the kind of sort of plush product, the enhanced product of a shared music experience which exists on iTunes, which exists yes. in the sort of MP3 world. And so you go to this enhanced experience called the concert in the same way that you go to the enhanced social network movie to get your and you go to see Resident Alien, which is the enhanced sort of plush product of the video game.
Yeah, and I think that what's really important to think about is I don't think that we'll sell books in the future. We should give them away. But we could sell the other experiences. Maybe it's a dinner with Kevin Kelly, or it's a once a week phone conversation with David Kirkpatrick. I think that, or whatever it is, or maybe it's you go jogging together. I don't know what those things are, but I think that the content is just whatever. Like I don't care about the content. I mean, the content's one thing. I think it's the other experiences surrounding that I think people will pay for in the future.
So I think you're right in the sense that there was a moment of history where the copy became really important, and we're kind of leaving that again. So right now, the ability to replicate a copy very quickly was kind of the product of the Industrial Revolution. Before that, it was very difficult, right? You had to write out a manuscript by hand. There was no copies of things. So Gutenberg kind of launched the idea of the copy. Then that idea of the copy that could be replicated for cheap became the industrial model.
And portable with the
codecs. And now we're kind of moving away from that. So we have this internet machine which will copy anything that touches it. So copies have basically become useless and free. So what we have to sell are things that cannot be copied easily. Right. That's the experience, that's the generatives, the immediacy, the personalization, all this stuff, which is very difficult to copy. We kind of have come back to that as the thing that's value, because the copy itself was the old model. And it was only temporary, as you suggest. It was kind of recent.
And temporary in a way that, I mean, we get all fired up when we hear Nicholas talking about this sort of dictatorship of the book that's had this hold, iron grip on civilization for so long. In fact, duplicating the portability of the codecs in an electronic form has been a really hard problem. It's conceivable that if the electronic sort of portable version of the book came out a month after Gutenberg, we'd be in a slightly different place. But the book, once you create the portable, and Nicholas describes it perfectly with that story, once the portability in an electronic form exists, it's utterly intuitive. The three-year-old gets it. You're done with the book. It's finished. Yeah. Let me ask you a question, David, here for a moment, and please don't consider me an enemy. Why should we be happy about Facebook? The world that Kevin Kelly was talking about years ago was a world in which we would program computers. We would exist in this sort of open architecture world where we would invent and create all kinds of applications together in this digital space. Now we go to this filter called Facebook. It seems Stalinist to me, not sort of futuristic, to have Facebook and Zuckerberg there.
Well, first of all, the key to that answer is that Facebook is a tool for efficient communication with other people, and we care about other people. That's the reason. I told Kevin a story last night. Something happened to me last night that exemplifies this idea. I was walking down Commonwealth Avenue, and I saw this woman standing on the corner of a street with this amazing smile on her face. And I was walking, and I was thinking, how could somebody just be standing there smiling like that? This person seems too happy, really. Yeah. And honestly, it was like, it didn't seem plausible.
It was Commonwealth Street, though.
Well, I live in New York. I don't know what that means. But so then I get around the corner, and I see she's talking on her cell phone. She was talking to another person, and that was the context in which she could be that happy, because I honestly don't think that person or anybody can really be as happy standing alone as they could be talking to another person.
You grew up in New York. In the 1960s, when you'd be on the street and you'd see people talking to themselves in New York, you'd go, they are crazy. Now you see them talking on the street, you go, oh, they're on their cell phone. This is what's changed.
I'm just saying that happiness comes from, more active interaction with other people, and Facebook facilitates it. Facebook is a more automated, more efficient way of doing it at scale with more people, and obviously 550 million people like that.
John, revert to the friendly guy here for a moment. I love, in fact, the phenomena that you talk about, and I think this evolution is exciting and wonderful, and you've all described sort of different slices of it. Nick, how do we manage the transformation better, or do we need to?
We're managing. I mean, it's funny. I wrote an article recently about I watched the World Cup, right, when it was on. And this time when I watched it, it was completely different than I did 4 years before. 4 years before, Twitter didn't exist. I didn't have an iPhone. Facebook, I couldn't have an account. I wasn't a college student. There was all these things that happened. And I watched it on my mobile phone in a park. I watched it on my computer while I was at work. I was tweeting. I was Facebooking. I was seeing real-time statistics. And the speed with which that changed was just unbelievable. How will I watch it in 4 years? It'll be completely different then. And I think we're managing these transitions really, really well. I think that we're making mistakes. We're taking two steps forward, one step back, and we're going through them. You know, we're figuring out privacy. I think privacy has become a new economy online. I give Gmail access to my emails because I don't want to pay them, I'm paying them with my privacy. And I think that we're kind of managing all this stuff together.
So privacy rather than as an entitlement of a sort of free democratic state, it becomes an enhanced experience.
Yep.
In a fundamentally different electronic world.
Yeah. It's a currency is what he's saying.
It's a currency.
It's a currency.
Questions out here? Get your hands up, please, and I will come around. Let me ask you, Nicholas, a question. 2 billion people do not have access to clean water in the world right now, and the world seems to function. Nevertheless, there is some urgency to get those people access to clean water. If there's a sort of similar situation in the 6 billion on the planet, that there's a disparity in the cost of entry to this world of communication that you describe, What is the threshold there? Does every 6 billion have to be able to be equally involved in this electronic world? Can it be a 4, 2, a 3, 3, a 1, 5? What do you envision as the best sort of scenario?
Well, what I'd suggest is to substitute the word education for digital, for electronic, for anything, and then the answer is real simple. Because everybody should have it, and it's, and we don't say let's hold off on education until we get clean water. You education is a human right. There are 7 countries already that have stated that connectivity is a human right, and I suspect within the next year or two, most countries will will move in that direction. So it's really become a human right, and it's not so much...
But if connected, if the means for education becomes this connectivity, does that accelerate education, or does it slow it down, as certain nations have difficulty acquiring the connectivity?
It accelerates it, because you now have a situation in terms of the connectivity that 85% of the world is connected with cell phones, and 95% of the world is within tower distance. So it's getting there.
Question here.
Yep. I would love to hear your responses to Malcolm Gladwell's recent article looking at...
Don't know it. I have a very funny story. I saw Malcolm Gladwell in a hotel a few weeks ago, right when my book had first came out, and I had 10
He's
copies.
He's hard to miss.
What's that?
He's hard to miss.
He's hard to miss. Well, I'd never met him before, and I really admire his work, and I had this moment. I got really excited, and I was like, oh my God, it's Malcolm Gladwell. And I had an extra book with me, and I went up to him when he was done talking to someone, and I said, hey, Malcolm, I just wrote this book, and I have no idea why I said this, but I was like, it's a really big accomplishment. And he was like, okay. And then I gave him one, and he asked me to sign it, and I was like really excited. I was really proud. And then the next day, that article came out, and he wrote this article saying that social networks are not, they can't be used for, what was the title?
All the things that I said they could be used for.
They can't be used for protests, that a relationship on Twitter or Facebook is not a real relationship. And I actually wanted to call him up and ask him for my book back. But I don't have his phone number.
Both of you are taking this very personally.
I did because I think it's just ludicrous. I think it's absolutely
ludicrous.
It's
idiotic. It just shows he didn't know what he was talking about. I mean, there's so much empirical evidence against his argument. I don't even know where he thought he... Did he do any research?
You know, let's just say that Gladwell is all about starting a conversation about, which poses the question, what is the quality of these different relationships? Do we have a sense of what is a relationship now, or in the sort of currency sense that you were talking about, Kevin, do we suddenly have huge increased numbers of gradations in the quality of relationships? How many friends do you have, David, on Facebook?
Me? I have 1,100.
You're not a serious person. You are not a serious person if you have 1,100 friends on Facebook.
They're not all real friends.
Kevin. Question is next.
So Matt. I think this is, again, the idea that what technology brings us is increasing varieties of things. So I think the way I would say is that you still have the opportunity to have as old-fashioned kind of relationship as you want with friends or your family. Those, you have plenty of opportunities to have old-fashioned types of relationships. What this new technology gives us is ways to have new kinds of relationships that we could not have before.
One doesn't replace the other.
It adds bandwidth between the extremes.
We're adding, it's always a plussing. We're adding yet new kinds of relationships that were not possible before without necessarily taking away the opportunity to have the old kind. And I look at my kids, and they have all these different kinds. They have, you know, the sleepovers and the same kind of stuff, and they have new kinds of relationships that they didn't have before. So there's an additional layering of new stuff without the old going away. And so there may be people who kind of fall into only the new, but actually I think they're rare. Most of us still retain the old. We understand the value of these other kinds. And so what I see is we're increasing the diversity and variety of the kinds of experiences and relationships that we can have.
David, quick thing. Let me just say on the questions, I'm going to be calling on people. Don't queue up at the mics. This woman will be next. Then you will be next down at this mic, and I'll get to you guys over there, but you can sit down.
Okay, I talk fast. So, you know, the basic point Gladwell was making was about politics and that this new media would not be an effective substitute for the kind of sit-ins at, the lunch counter, you know, to desegregate or whatever. But, you know, the very week that article came out, the New York Times had an article about Syria in which it said that in Syria, where Facebook is banned, it is widely used anyway by the elite through proxy servers, and a teacher beat his students in class, and it was videoed on a cell phone and put on Facebook, and the teacher was fired because of the dialogue that happened on Facebook. This is in a despotic dictatorship where Facebook is banned. So that is activism.
Now, wait a minute. Is that a good thing?
I mean,
or
it's just one. It's just
thing.
One teacher. It was also about a whole lot of other things that are happening in Syria because of Facebook's popularity there, which are undercutting Assad. The fact is, it works, and it's just happening in almost every country on the planet.
If anyone has a video of Malcolm Gladwell beating anyone, please put it on Facebook, right here.
Thank you so much. so much. This has been phenomenal.
Get closer to the mic. Okay, closer to the mic.
This has been phenomenal. Can you touch upon local, and I'm thinking in the guise of Foursquare and Groupon, and where you see that taking us?
I think local's huge. I mean, it's going to be a multi-billion dollar industry. It's replacing the advertising industry that exists in newspapers. It's replacing the local sales that you used to see in your local post office. I mean, it is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's why everyone is going after it, from Google to Facebook to Foursquare to Twitter. And I think that's essentially where it is. And the idea of, I think that what we're moving towards now with having these devices that we all walk around is hyper personalization, and that also sinks into local experiences. So if I pull out my phone at 4 o'clock in the morning in Brooklyn, New York, and want to read the New York Times, it will be designed in a way that represents that, and so will the advertising and the local experiences around that. I think
here's a question though. In this world where all these different relationships develop, and these impulses to communicate are easier and easier and easier. And you've also mentioned pornography, so I think that's the subject's on the table. Do we have a difficulty sometimes evaluating these relationships? Let's take a story that's in the news right now. Is Brett Favre a pervert or just an idiot? It's an important question.
Is all
of the above, good. But what I'm saying is there are impulses, low cost of entry or low stakes, let's describe them, impulses to communicate that become, through the sort of distortions of celebrity and the sort of background echo chamber of the media, have these huge impacts that distort the original relationship. And I'm not excusing Brett Favre, who I think is an idiot and a pervert and a bad quarterback at this stage in his career. But how is that story an indication of our difficulty or ease in which that we reevaluate these various kinds of relationships?
I don't think it's really. I mean, every single media, when it has come along, people have called it debasing, that it caters to the base instincts, and that goes for the romantic novel, to the Telegraph, whatever it is. There was always
writing.
There's always accusation that it's just catering to the base instincts, and it probably does, but. The point is that no technology is really powerful unless it can be powerfully abused. We should expect the abuse of any powerful technology powerfully. And the reason why this is not just a wash, it's not just a neutral thing, is because every new technology brings with it a new choice between destruction and creation. And that choice itself is a good, which tips it slightly in favor of the good.
Ma'am?
Wow.
Right here, please.
I have a question. I was thinking about the way I grew up and how, I'm 24, and the way I grew up is very, very different from someone who's 40 years old and the way that they grew up. But the world
For noting that.
The way that I grew up is going to be very, very different from someone who's 20 years old right now and how they grew up, and the person who's 18 years old and the way they grew up. And I feel like these generational gaps are just widening and widening. How do you think that that's going to impact the world, and how do you think we're going to be able to kind of continue on with society if the way everyone's growing up is so different?
A great last question. Unfortunately, that will have to be the last one because this time has whipped by. Let's thank the panelists here with an applause and get a response to their question. Great, great last question. Why don't each one of you take it?
Well, I was just going to start, the question you asked earlier about why we should even kind of be discussing it, that's sort of the answer. The pace of change has accelerated to such an extraordinary degree that it is true that 20-year-olds are almost generationally different than 17-year-olds today. And if that continues to accelerate, we have a lot of thinking to do about what it means. And I'm not saying it's all good, or I do think generally Nick's right that we will be able to adapt more quickly. I think you both said that. But you all said that. Anyway, so it's a pace of change is just an inevitability, which is why, in effect, we all are writing our books and trying to understand this stuff. This is a central issue for modern society, and technology is the driver of that pace of change. And I think the mobile device is the most obvious manifestation. We all insist on carrying a computer with us at all times, which is why the local question, everything is going to be local. Yeah. There isn't going to be a local business. We're going to just be broadcasting all the time, and it's privacy implicated. This is tough stuff. We don't know where the world's going. I think it's going to be very interesting, though.
So I think that part of what we're realizing is there a kind of literacy that's not just related to the alphabet, or in numeracy, which is related to understanding numbers, but a kind of a techno-literacy. And that's sort of understanding. In other words, the answer is education. We have to understand, and we can be trained to deal with the fact that when we learn something, it's going to be obsolete in 5 years, that when we buy something, it's already obsolete, that every new technology produces new problems, that there's generational divides in this. And so this is something that basically we have to train ourselves to deal with. And in the sense that it's not just by osmosis, I think that just like you can't learn the alphabet by osmosis, it takes, you know, whatever it is, 3 or 4 or 5 years to learn how to read. We are actually going to have to take some time and train ourselves to learn how to deal with this technological world. And there are certain skills that are going to be required, and I think part of that is the skills of learning how to be intergenerational, how to communicate with those next generation. That's just going to be a skill that people will have to learn and be trained to do and understand that, yes, they've got this stuff, but people who are 3 years younger, they've got something different. How do we relate to them? It's something we can learn how to do.
Nick and then Nicholas.
I think it's, you know, it's fascinating because I had a moment where the New York Times where I when the Sony e-reader first came out a few years ago, and I was really excited. I was like, this is the first e-reader I've ever touched. And I went and I showed it to one of the senior editors, and they kind of threw it back at me, and they were like, I wouldn't want to read on that. And my thought was, it's not about what you want to read. It's about what the people that you're talking to want to read. Right, and I think that's the same thing that's going to happen with these digital divides that are now taking place between generations. It's not necessarily about what you want to do, but you have to think about what your audience and your customer wants to do. And you can see a perfect example with Facebook. I had this moment in the book I wrote about where there was a young teenage girl that came over to my house with a friend of the family and asked if she could borrow my computer to check the news. So I gave her the laptop, and I'm making some coffee, and I'm thinking to myself, I wonder what news site she's going to. Is she checking the Bits blog or CNN or what is it? And I said, which news site are you going to? And she doesn't even blink. She looks up, and she says, Facebook, and puts her head back down. And for her, she's grown up with that thing called the news feed, which is her news, right? And we have to, as a reporter, I have to understand that I can't expect her to come to nytimes.com to consume that content. I have to give it to her where she consumes it. And I think that's just, it's a matter of you adapting to them, not the other way around.
Nicholas?
Well, I think that the biggest change that we've seen is the change in our attitude toward change. Seriously. And the fact that you would even ask the question and pose it as a question puts you light years ahead. Do you realize that when you ask the question, you recognize that it's there? And the divide that occurred, call it a digital divide or a generation, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we didn't recognize it. In other words, the fact that you're even asking already says to me that there's not a problem here, that you're growing up knowing this is going to happen. So it's we're in a much better situation, and bless you for asking it, because I think that's the answer.
It is the essential point. Let me tell you a great story. First of all, an executive producer in radio used to say to me that if radio shows end with somebody, and Kevin just did it, saying the solution is education, you should always feel like that's a failure. But in this particular case, it's education plus an awareness of the change that you've articulated here and that all of you have articulated so well. Elites don't do this really well. I used to be in television a long time ago, and I once was at a Christmas party with Jack Welch, who was the head of GE at the time. I worked for NBC. The head of NBC News, who was Andy Lack at the time. The head of NBC Network. And two other senior executives at General Electric, and they were all sitting around at Christmas, and they were talking about what the object of the year was. And this was many years ago. And these are all people who have made billions of dollars, millions at least, in advertising-supported media. And they were all describing, oh, man, I tell you, you know, I love my TiVo. Jack Welch is saying to Andy Lack, I love my TiVo, and I love my TiVo. All of the senior executives at the network that I worked at, we're talking about their TiVos, a device that was made to strip out advertising for content. And they all were joking and laughing and having a great time. I was sweating and terrified, and I knew at that moment that my job was gone, that it was over, and I'm in radio today. Thank you very much.